Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Insight into Healing. My name is Alexa Servidio and I am your host. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I have a great show planned for us. Just a reminder, this show is for educational purposes only and should never take the place of your own personal medication management or individual or family therapy. And always go to your primary care doctor or to a psychiatrist or a therapist in person in your own town, in your own area, if you have any questions or concerns. Let's go to our first question. Dear Insight into Healing, I am a single mom of three boys. Their ages range from age 8 to 13 years old. I am concerned because they don't have a male figure in their life. What do you recommend? I often get this question a lot from single moms, and I know it becomes an issue or a concern when young boys growing up do not have a father in the house or a father in the picture on a full-time basis or even a part-time basis. One thing that I usually recommend to my clients is also finding out what is your son's involved in? What are your sons interested in? Sometimes some boys can be interested in sports. Sometimes they're interested in different types of activities. Is it music? Is it arts? Is it writing? And I think first really finding out, are your children, each one, are they into group activities or individual activities? And what I mean by this, sometimes some boys are team groups. They like to be on the football team. They like to be on the baseball team. They like to have group activities. While your other child might be into more individual type of activities. And one isn't right, one isn't wrong. They're both very healthy, and they also just decide what your child is interested in. Maybe an individual type of activity could be writing, could be some sort of game by himself, could be a science project. Researching certain things. And I think really speaking to your three sons, you said they're from the ages of 8 to 13. So there are different stages in their life. So I think each one will probably have something different than the other child that they would be interested in. I think once you define that, what they're interested in, if it's group or individual, then starting to look into what type of things does your community resources have. Do they have a local Y near you that have different activities? Maybe your child, for someone who likes, you know, a group activity, do they have different classes? If they're interested in computers, they could have a computer class. Or do they give different sports? Are there acting classes? Are they also music classes? I think also if maybe your child is interested in more of a one-on-one type of connection, maybe seeing if your son would like to take up an instrument. Is he interested in the drums? Maybe getting him, you know, an instructor for music. I know a lot of towns and a lot of states have music programs. I know they might be limited because there's a lot of budget cuts. But I would see if maybe there is, you know, some sort of music program. And if he can have, if there is a male teacher or male instructor, this might be the bonding relationship that could be encouraged. This could maybe, you know, help him fill that void. And I'm also wondering with this question, is this question coming from you or have your children brought this up to you? Because I'm wondering, do they really feel that they need a male figure? And I do believe boys and girls both need a mother and father figure in their life to some degree. Might not be the actual mother or the actual father, but I think different role models to show them and to teach them, you know, different values in life that as children we learn from our mentors, from our parents. So I think, first of all, if it's coming from you, I think it's really sitting down with yourself and saying, what are you feeling about this? Is this something that you feel that you're lacking, that you're not providing for your children? Is this something about your own personal self-esteem? or is this about your own childhood? Also, if this is something your sons are requesting, I think it's really asking them, you know, what is it that you're looking for? What is it that you feel that, you know, you need? Do you miss that, you know, maybe someone to throw the ball around? Not saying that women can't throw football or can't play sports with their sons, but I think finding out what is it that, is it the male contact? Is it having a male mentor? There's also a lot of big brother type of organizations you could bring your sons to that have those big brother events. They can go out and have, you know, be assigned an older adult, an older, you know, maybe an older adolescent to take them to the park, to take them, you know, out to eat, to teach them different things. Maybe they can build something together. And I think also looking into that, seeing if there's any type of big brother programs. And then also if you belong to a local church, they usually have different groups for, you know, male groups, female groups. So they might have something like a male connection group where, you know, older men can help teach younger men, you know, different ways of building things, different, you know, different roles, different ways of growing up. And that might be something for your children to really start, you know, looking up to a male figure. And I think also taking a look at what was your male figure in your life? What was it, a positive one? Was it a negative one? And I think really exploring that and saying, what am I looking for my sons to have? What am I not looking for? You know, what would I like them to be learning? What type of behavior would I like them to be modeling? And I think really also sitting down with your three sons and explaining, I'm not sure where the father is, if he's in their life at all, and kind of being honest to a certain degree, because some things children can't carry, they can't deal with, it's not, they're too young to be dealing with it. But I think really opening up that discussion of what's going on, and you know, to some degree saying, you know, what do they feel that they're missing, if anything at all. I mean, your children might be okay at this point, and later on they might be fine. Or, you know, you're probably doing an amazing job with them. But I would really explore with them what's going on, and also really explore with yourself what's going on with you. And when you said you're concerned, what do you see happening? What are your concerns? Do you feel that they might not be, you know, they might not respect other men, they might not know how to do certain things? I think really exploring that, and also making sure you're not getting stuck and caught up in the stereotypes and what society says somebody has to look like, what the male role model has to look like, what the female role model has to look like. And I think really being open to it and saying, okay, what do I provide for my three sons, and what do you think that they would want? What do you think they would need? And what do you think is a possibility? And what is their stuff? And what is your own personal, you know, agenda going on? And really sitting with yourself and being honest. And I know it can be tough. It's not an easy thing. But sometimes, you know, it's life. Sometimes the fathers or the male figures are not in the life. You know, they're not in the children's life. So it's something to see how you can work through that and how you can process that with your three sons. It sounds like you're doing a great job, and it sounds like you have a lot of insight into what's going on. So please send us a note. You can send a letter back to insightintohealing@gmail.com, or find us on Facebook and let us know what's going on and if you have any other questions. Let's go on to our second question. Dear Insight into Healing, I have been divorced for a few years now, and as I am processing my marriage and history of abuse, I have been told that my ex was a narcissist. He had lots of fits of rage and anger. He was living a fake life, a lie, because he was really attracted to men and not women. I feel that he deceived me through my whole marriage. Is this narcissism? And is it a narcissistic personality? Is that a diagnosis? Yes, narcissistic personality is a diagnosis. It's number 301.81 in the DSM-4. It's narcissistic personality disorder. So I got the DSM-4 right in front of me, so I'll read it. People with narcissistic personality disorder have a lifelong pattern of grandiosity in behavior and in fantasy, thirst for admiration, a lack of empathy. So what this means is they have the need to be the center of attention. What I usually say is, you know, sometimes when there's a narcissistic personality in the room, because there's no other room for anyone else in the room, in the relationship, in life, a narcissistic personality disorder type person demands to be the center, demands to be the whole fit of attention. These attitudes permeate most of the aspects of their lives. They feel they are unusually special. They are self-important individuals who commonly exaggerate their accomplishments to make them seem bigger than life. It should be noted from the outset that these traits constitute a personality disorder only in adults. Children and teenagers are naturally self-centered in this age range. Narcissistic traits don't necessarily imply ultimate personality disorder. So that was very interesting to make sure that teenagers and young adults do not really have narcissistic, because that's usually, you know, when you're in your teenage years, you think you're, you know, you want all the attention and you have that higher self-esteem. So what they are saying, usually the onset is in adults. So the criteria for narcissistic personality disorder, beginning by early adult life, grandiosity, fantasized or actual, lack of empathy, a need for admiration are present in a variety of situations, shown by at least five of these. One, a grandiose sense of self-importance. Example, a patient will exaggerate own abilities and accomplishments. Two, preoccupation with fantasies of beauty, brilliance, ideal love, power, or limitless success. Three, belief that personal uniqueness renders the patient fit only for association with or understanding by people or institutions rarefied by status. So a lot of people with narcissistic personality disorder are very preoccupied with status, with control, with being very important, with being very, you know, head of the game, of better than everybody else. Need for excessive admiration, a sense of entitlement. Patient unreasonably expects favorable treatment or automatic granting of own wishes. Exploitation of others to achieve personal goals. Lack of empathy, which means patient does not recognize or identify the feelings and needs of others. See, that was very interesting. I know you were saying that your husband had fits of rage, was very angry. It was about him all the time. You felt that he was living a lie, being married to a female when he was really attracted to men. So I think it's that identifying with himself and his needs over your needs. So that might be a criteria right there. Frequent envy of others or belief that others envy the patient. Arrogance or haughtiness in attitude or behavior. So with this, it doesn't say much anger. They're not saying that there's a lot of anger. I mean, they're really driven for their internal drive for success. They fantasize about wild success and envy those that have achieved it. So I'm wondering when you were saying, you know, that you felt that your husband was living a lie, you know, because he was obviously attracted to men and he was married to a woman. I'm wondering with kind of living that double life, living, you know, having that self-importance, if that somehow was manifested in the anger, was manifested in the fits of rage, you said, and anger of him being able to live a lie. And I don't think that, you know, narcissism and anger are always, you know, the same together and they're connected together. But I think that whole of not being able to be self-important, not being able to explain to everybody that, you know, he is attracted to men and not being allowed to live has, and in his own mind, meanwhile, that had nothing to do with you, but in his own mind, not being able to express himself as a homosexual man, a lot of that anger must have come out of there, a lot of the rage. I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's justified by any means, but I'm wondering with a lot of those fits of rage and anger, it's feelings of, you know, being disloyal to himself, a lot of insecurity, a lot of these narcissistic personality disorders, you feel that they have such a high self-esteem. They think of themselves so great, but a lot of times they have very low self-esteem. So they portray themselves as bigger than life and, you know, that they can take over anything and they're very strong, but really they are very down deep, a very insecure, scared, anxious, nervous type of person, but by using the anger and the fits of rage, they can control people. And so it's very interesting, you're saying, you know, you were kind of processing the abuse and the marriage and everything that's going on, and I think there's so many layers right now of what you're going through. I think one, it's the divorce, and as you might have heard on my other shows, it's, I feel that divorce is a death. It's a death of an ideal. It's a death of a relationship. It's a death of an ideal relationship with a person, and it's also a spiritual death in some way, because if you were married in the church, you made that promise to God, you know, in front of God. So if you are also a spiritual person, I find that it could really attack your spiritual growth at times, and really kind of, it hits you at all levels. It hits you at emotional, mental, physical, spiritual. So it's really a grieving process of that, of the ideal of what you had. And I think then when you add on the betrayal, or the fake life of that he's actually a homosexual man, that brings it to another layer. And I find so many times women will say, if only I was skinnier, if only if I was prettier, if only, you know, intimately and maybe I was a little more adventurous, he would be attracted to me and not be attracted to men. And that's not the case. And I think there's so much judgment going on, and it sounds like also in your marriage that there was abuse. You've been put down and judged so much. I want to make sure you don't put down and judge yourself. There's no room for that. That will get you nowhere. Going back playing, you know, as they say, Monday morning quarterback, if only I did this, or maybe if the meal was better, if I was home on time, or, you know, I lost that weight, or I was a little bit sweeter. That, you know, yes, that can help enhance the relationship, enhance the marriage, but that is not what is the point, the turning point for someone to be homosexual to a straight life. If this is something he felt and this is something he was, a homosexual man, I feel no matter professionally, no matter how skinny you were, now how good cook you were, how good you were behind closed doors, that this wouldn't have that impact. This is who he is. So I think that also is another layer for you to process. And it says you've been divorced, you know, going through this for a couple of years now. And I find also, if you've looked up the stages of grief, as I said before in past shows, there's 5 stages. So it sounds like you said when I was, you know, going back and forth with you, that there's a lot of anger, and that you've really been caught in this anger stage for the last 2 years. And I know, you know, there's not a set time on how long you're going to be angry. There's not, you know, okay, it's been 6 months, now I'm fine, I'll get over it. Grieving and processing doesn't work like that. Each person is so different, but I think it's really a good point, a healthy start, where when I was speaking with you, you said, I don't want to be angry anymore. Now, that's a huge step, even though it might not feel like that was really, you know, it doesn't feel like you're in a good place, it doesn't feel like you're healing, but you are. You are moving forward, and you've made that statement, and you've come to that realization, I don't want to be angry anymore. So I think you really are on a good path, you're moving forward, and I think sometimes, you know, you'll start thinking back of everything. You kind of start, you know, we do this so many times, and I've seen so many of my clients do it, kind of go through every situation, everything, I could have done this, oh, I should have seen this, I should have known right now. Someone even actually told me, I think maybe, you know, are you sure your husband's attracted to men and women? You know, you don't know. When you're in the middle of something, especially when there's abuse, you don't have that ability. Most of the time I find with many of my clients, you don't have that ability to kind of rationalize and think outside the box. Especially if there's emotional abuse, physical abuse, your concentration is on survival. Your concentration is on moving day by day and just surviving. So the idea of, and you know, you're putting such pressure on yourself, you're kind of setting yourself up to fail by saying, I should have known, I should have had the strength. You know, we all should have had, have, could have, would have. But I think going back there and getting caught in that whole negativity, that whole judgment process is not healthy. So I would recommend, you know, try if you can, if you feel like you're very angry and you're kind of almost obsessing or ruminating about the relationship, about what could have been done, I should have done this, to assign yourself one time a day, if you can, if it can be an hour, it could be 20 minutes. That is the only time. Say it's Tuesdays between 3 to 4. Tuesdays between 3 and 4, you will sit there and go over every single event, everything you want to obsess and ruminate about. But then when it comes 4 o'clock, you set a stopwatch. You stop. No matter if you finished something in your mind or if you just started a new thought, you have to stop. And why I do this is I want to start having you retrain your thought process so you're not having those automatic thoughts. It's also keeping a thought record of kind of saying, how much do we have these negative thoughts? As I said before, it's like kind of a negative monologue we have rolling and running constantly in our head. We want to start adjusting that monologue, but we can't take it all away because that's kind of been a defense mechanism or a negative coping skill you've had for so long. So slowly we want to start peeling back some of the negativity and replacing it with some positive and healthy ways of taking care of yourself. And I think when you plan like an hour, you're going to sit there and just ruminate about it. After a while, you start gaining control over it. You start kind of looking, almost, you know, looking at it like, really, I have to schedule an hour? And you might not want to do it anymore. But I find when we try to stop ourselves from thinking something negative, saying, I'm just going to get over it. Why can't I get over it? You actually make yourself more anxious and kind of obsess more about it. So give yourself the permission for that hour to do it, but then you have to stop. And I know sometimes at first it might be very hard, and you might kind of get wrapped into it, and you only really want to be able to allow yourself to do this if you're safe. At any time, if you feel any suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideations, or any homicidal thoughts, homicidal, if you want to hurt yourself or if you want to hurt, you know, your ex-husband or his lover, that is when you stop. You do not want to get caught up in that if you do not have that mind frame to be able to stop and start. What I would recommend if you can is finding a psychiatrist and a therapist in your area and meeting with them and really processing this and really being able to say who it is, say what it is. And I know sometimes we talk to our friends and family members and they just don't want to hear about it anymore and they're angry because you keep talking about it and you keep going back. And that happens. That's why I think it's so important to find an outside party, a third party, an objective party, to be able to process this. So there's no judgment. You're able to sit there and really express this and get feedback or support from someone who's not involved personally in the situation. And it really brings it to a different area. It really gives you a different type of insight into what's going on and also getting a professional opinion, and also you're in a safe environment. I wouldn't recommend going into this whole negativity thoughts and obsessing and ruminating if you feel it's going to spiral out of control and you're going to do something, especially if you have a history of violence or if he has a history of violence. You know, you want to make sure safety first. You're always, always trying to be safe and always doing what's best for you. And make sure you're also taking care of yourself. Is it going for a walk? Is it reading a book? Is it, you know, going to church, reading Bible verses? Make sure you really take care of yourself. And I know sometimes when you're in these emotional, physical type of abusive relationships, what happens is you don't care about yourself anymore because you don't think you're worth anything. You are worth something. We have to start changing that thinking, and it does not come overnight. It takes time. So even if you don't believe it, I want you to start saying positive affirmations. Maybe reading a very healthy self-help book. Maybe reading some Bible verses. Something that promotes healthiness and positivity and empowerment. And even if you don't believe it, keep doing it, because sooner or later you will start to believe it, but you can't ruminate in the negativity and figure out, I could have done this, this would have happened. That will do no good. That will not help you in any way. That will actually cause more damage and more trauma. So we want to make sure you're number one. You really have to take care of yourself, be good to yourself, and start to heal. Well, that will bring us into our first song, Waiting for Tomorrow by Mandisa.
Let you in, let you in.
was Waiting for Tomorrow by Mandisa. Let's go on to our next question. Dear Insight into Healing, what is the difference between crack and cocaine? Are they addictive? Yes, I can definitely tell you, yes, they are addictive. I looked into on the internet, there was a site that said, compare anything, cocaine versus crack, the differences and the comparison. This said, crack and cocaine are both drugs created from the cocoa plant, but have a different level of refinement. Crack cocaine, often nicknamed crack, after the sound is made during its manufacture, is a lower purity form of free base cocaine and contains sodium bicarbonate as impurity. It is a solid smokable form of cocaine. It is a free base form of cocaine that can be made by using baking soda and sodium hydroxide in a process to convert cocaine hydrochloride into a free base cocaine. So that is very different. Cocaine is usually administered topical, oral, encephalation, or by IV. Crack is by smoking. Cocaine is a crystalline tropane alkaloid that is obtained from the leaves of a cocoa plant, and the name comes from cocoa in addition to the alkaloid suffix INE. It is a stimulant of the central nervous system. Crack cocaine is a solid smokable form of cocaine. It is a free-based form of cocaine that can be made, as I said, using baking soda. But what is really interesting is that what they say is crack and cocaine, I know sometimes there's so many, you know, you get kind of confusion about what's going on, but I think it really sounds, the administration, the way you use crack and cocaine are so different. Crack is just by smoking, they're saying here, and cocaine is topical oral IV. So I think that's definitely one of the big differences. As they said, the common method of ingesting crack is smoking. So I think that becomes very, very serious with the smoking. So I think you can definitely find out the differences there. And I said, are they addictive? All drugs are addictive. And I think sometimes people feel that, oh, if I do it once or if I do it twice, it's not a big deal. But crack, cocaine are very highly addictive. So you want to make sure that you really have a good awareness about what you're really doing. And I know a lot of times I've been getting a lot of questions of what's going on, why has cocaine become so prevalent? It's become such an epidemic up there with heroin. And crack, too, has also become a very, very serious epidemic. And I know sometimes people think, oh, that's, you know, that only happens in lower neighborhoods, low-income areas. That doesn't happen in nice areas where you know, there's a lot of money or good schools. That's not the truth, and I think that's what becomes really frightening, is that, as I said before, drugs don't discriminate. It's not based on where you live, who you know, how much money you have. I think if you're going to become addicted, of course, there's other factors, environmental factors, genetics, other things going on about, you know, what raises the degree or the chances of you becoming addictive. But I think coming to any drug is you want to be very careful about addiction. And I think you really want to make sure you know what's going on. It's become such a huge problem. And I think a lot of our young people try this or do this because everybody else is doing it and then find themselves addicted. These drugs so far, you know, what I've been hearing in my professional group is that they're being mixed with other things, other chemicals, that things have become so dangerous that people are dying right away. And I think anytime using a drug, really being honest and saying the chance of dying, of death, of overdose is there. And I think we don't want to live in a fantasy world where we think, you know, everyone says it's not going to happen to me. It can. So you really want to be very careful and really, you know, keep a check-in. And if you really feel that this has become addictive or this has become a problem, again, as I said in past shows, this is something you can't do on your own. I would recommend professionally to go into a rehab. Go see a psychiatrist. Go to your primary care doctor. See a therapist and get help. You do not want to go through withdrawal alone. You don't want to go through the detox. And you don't want to go through this program of going through the detox and withdrawal on your own. And programs come so you can get the support of others. And there's a reason for that. There's local groups, you know, NA, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's also, those are outpatient groups you can go to, meetings, Or you can also go into a rehab program. Some days it's 3 days, some days it's 30 days, some days it's 6 months. And I think it's really, you know, when it becomes this serious, finding out what's best for you and really listening to the professionals. Now, they said the appearances and characteristics of crack and cocaine. Cocaine in its purest form is white, pearly product. Again, cocaine appearing in a powder form of salt. The color of crack depends upon several factors, including the origin of the cocaine, method of preparation with ammonia or baking soda, but will generally range from white to a yellowish cream or to a light brown. So I think that you can definitely start noticing the difference. I'm not sure if this is something the person who wrote this in, if you yourself are using or you're suspecting a family member, a friend, or a loved one is using drugs and not sure if it's crack or if it's cocaine. So I think, one, if you're able to see how they're using it, are they smoking it, are they snorting it, are they shooting it up, then you can tell the difference if it's crack or cocaine. And if you actually see the product, is it white, then it's more of the cocaine. If it's more of a yellowish, brownish, then it would be the crack. So I think it's really being serious and really checking it out and saying, you know, what is going on? As I said, the duration of cocaine effects depends on the route of administration. Sniffing cocaine may last 15 to 30 minutes. Smoking crack delivers large quantities to the lungs, producing effects of comparable to the intravenous injection. These effects are felt for immediately after smoking and are very intense and last 5 to 10 minutes. Now, as you see, a lot of the effects or the lasting effects of using the drug, as you say, the high, doesn't last that long. And I think that's why it also becomes so addictive. And it's such a serious thing because, you know, you get it, you use it 5-10 minutes, it's over. As in any addiction, any drug, you want more. That 5-10 minutes of being high is you're chasing your high. You want to do it again. You want to feel better. So you keep doing more. You keep, you know, increasing, which means you are becoming more addicted. Your tolerance is going up. So it's very serious, and that's kind of the process of addiction. And you're always chasing that high. You're always looking to do more. And what happens is it only lasts 15, 30 minutes, and you have to go and get more, it starts, you know, really, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of chasing things around, a lot of putting yourself in danger, which are also huge red flags that there is an addiction going on. So you really want to take a good look at yourself and take, as I would say, a personal inventory of what's going on and being really honest, saying, is this something that's going out of control? Or if you're thinking, is this something I want to try? Why? This is really, nothing good can come out of this. This is a very dangerous road you are choosing to travel or that you are traveling on. You're always going to need more. You're always going to up your tolerance. It's always going to be going higher and higher. And, you know, you're really putting yourself in danger and at risk of death. So I hope that answered your question. Again, if you have any future questions or ideas for upcoming shows, please send an email to insightintohealing@gmail.com. All names are anonymous. I will never give out any information. We have complete confidentiality. Or you can private message me on Facebook at Insight into Healing. Let's go on to our next question. Dear Insight into Healing, I feel unmotivated and depressed most of the time. After my second child, I gained 40 pounds. I feel unattractive and fat. How do I start feeling good about myself? Well, this is what I find I hear a lot of from women who have had a child, their first, their third, or not even having children, that you start to feel unmotivated. Sometimes when you start to gain weight, you start to feel unmotivated. You start to feel a depression. And it says I feel unmotivated and depressed. Right there, let's look at that statement. How long has this been going on? Because I also want to make sure that this might not be a sign of depression. I think so we really want to look at onset, when it started, duration, how long it's going. How long does it last? Is it in cycles? Do you feel really, really happy for a while and then really sad? Is it lasting for weeks, months? Is this something that's been kind of underlying for the last year or two? This is something you really want to be able to start looking at. And I think also I would, if you feel that it's gone to a place where you said you're unmotivated, when you say unmotivated, are you not enjoying life as you used to? Are you isolating? Are you not doing the same activities you used to do? Are you staying home? Are there bouts of crying? Are there any suicidal ideations, suicidal gestures, thoughts that you're not enough, thoughts that you don't want to go on? If that is going on, number one, how do you start feeling better about yourself? I would go immediately to a psychiatrist or to a therapist and get an evaluation. I want to see if there's depression. I want to see if there's any suicidal history, suicidal ideation. I want to make sure you're safe. That's number one. We always on this show do safety first. Then you said after my second child I gained the 40 pounds. Also looking, how long did it go right away? Was it from your pregnancy? And also, when did the depression or the did that start after the birth of your second child? We also want to try and rule out if it's postpartum. So I would also, I would go maybe to your primary care doctor if you don't feel it comfortable going to a psychiatrist right away or finding a therapist. I would go to your primary care doctor and make sure you get checked to see if there's postpartum. Feeling, you know, you gained 40 pounds, you're feeling unattractive, you're feeling fat. Let's go on to that area. Feelings of not being attractive, feeling, you know, low self-esteem. Ways to start working on that on an emotionally, mental level is not allowing yourself, and it's easier said than done, to beat yourself up. As I said in some of the other questions before, life is so tough. There's always negative people. There's people, you know, putting us down or talking about us and being hard on us. We don't need to do that to ourselves. That negative self-talk, that negative emotional beatdown that we put on ourselves and berating ourselves and that negative monologue will never motivate us. It will never do anything healthy for us. It won't be, oh, okay, now I'm going to get up and do it. You're only reinforcing the negative feelings and the lack of motivation and really feeding yourself very toxic thoughts that have no reason for being there. So I would really, number one, try to, again, look at that negative monologue. Write it down. How long is it going on? Is this something that you allow, you know, under the surface to be going in your head, I'm not good enough, I'm fat, I'm this, I'm that, no one likes it. We want to try and cut that out. So we want to make sure we get some positive affirmations. So even if you don't believe it, I am good enough. I am beautiful. I will lose this weight. It's only weight. This doesn't define me. My weight does not define me. And really working on that. And then also, I'm not sure if you started an exercise program. Again, getting a doctor or physician's approval before you do any type of fitness program. I'm also a certified personal trainer. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. And aerobics instructor. So once you would get your physician's approval that you could work out, if you're not already, is I would start a workout program. It also helps with the depression. Working out exercise really physically has been shown and proven helps alleviate depression, anger, anxiety. So I would maybe, if you can, if you don't have any injuries or anything, start walking. If you're not into a gym mentality, because a lot of people, when they're not feeling too good about themselves, the idea of going to a gym and being with all these people in tight clothes and skinny and all that stuff, it's too frightening. It's too overwhelming. So maybe going for a walk. I don't know if you have maybe any exercise equipment in your house. Doing an exercise, you know, using the equipment in your house. Watching an exercise video. Even if you can only do 10 minutes at first, it's better than nothing. We are not expecting results the first time you exercise. Results start happening weeks after, months after. But don't let that discourage you. We've got to kind of get you in all areas, emotionally, mentally, physically. We spiritually, we have to feed you healthy in all those areas in order for you to start feeling better by yourself. It's not that I'm just going to, you know, exercise 24 hours a day and I'll feel better. That's not addressing the depression, feeling unmotivated, not feeling good about yourself. That is part of helping the problem, but that's not the end all be all. I think so many people get confused and don't realize you really have to address all areas of your life, all areas of your being, in order to be a healthy, fruitful, positive, motivated person. So I would definitely, number one, start off with going to see, you know, checking out your depression, seeing how long it's been, seeing when it started. Is it something new? Is it something that's been there? Going to a psychiatrist, going to a therapist, going to your primary care doctor, rule out depression. Rule out postpartum. After that, you know, kind of being really aware of the negative monologues you allow in your mind, negative thoughts. start to incorporate more positive thinking in that area and building on that. And then, you know, after you get your doctor's approval, starting an exercise program so you can really start, you know, putting into action physically. So you're actually doing action mentally, emotionally, and physically. And then also, you know, really being incorporating all those three in order to move forward. So thank you so much for your question. That will bring us into our next song by Mandisa, Overcomer. Mandisa, Overcomer. I know I've played that a lot on my show. I just love that song so much. I find it so uplifting, so motivating, and the video is just really amazing too. So if you haven't checked it out, I would definitely check out the video for Mandisa. The song is called Overcomer, and I've been asked a couple of times where I find my songs. A lot of times there's a radio station. I'm here stationed in New York. I listen to a station called 96.7 K-Love. It's on the radio, where I find it plays all Christian type of music. So a lot of these songs I take from there, and I've heard from there. So they're great inspiration, great encouragement. So before the show is over, let's do our journaling exercise. You are going to write down three strengths that you have and how they've changed your life and why. Let's go into three strengths that you have. These are strains that you could have had as a child, strains you had growing up, strains you have now, strains that if you're overcoming a sickness, an illness, maybe a horrific relationship, any type of trauma or abuse, what that strength is. And I want three separate strengths that you have. You know, explore them. Write down. It doesn't have to be a whole essay, but write down, you know, is it resilience, communication, good heart? Write those three strengths down. And then try to pinpoint, if you can, in different areas of your life, when you utilize those strengths. Is it getting over a car accident? Is it when you failed a test in school or a fight in a relationship? And write down that event and why you think having that strength changed you, gave you the ability to overcome or still process or overcome any type of struggle you were going through, and why you think this has helped. I find so many times, you know, a lot of my journal exercises are about, you know, really becoming aware, gaining insight into your strengths and also into barriers. But why I like to assign these journaling exercises is I find that, you know, life can be so busy and we can get caught up in so many things. And unfortunately, you know, we sometimes get caught up in negative thoughts. And we're always, you know, we have those negative monologues running, that we really don't take time to sit back and treat ourselves well. So being proud of your three strengths and putting it down, that's a huge accomplishment, having those three strengths. You probably have even more. If you have more than three strengths, write them down. And make sure if you can't think of three strengths, don't just finish the exercise right there. I want you to keep really working on yourself and give yourself, you know, compliment yourself. You know, I think also if you're stuck in a depression or you're stuck in an abusive relationship or not in a good place in your life, you don't see anything good about yourself. You don't feel good about yourself. We have to make it a point to feel good about ourselves, to say good things about ourselves. I'm not saying being obnoxious and bragging. It's a difference. It's being humble, but it's being good to yourself. And you have, if you can't do that for yourself, how do you teach your children? How do you teach your friends? How do you teach loved ones? You have to role model for others how to treat you, how you treat yourself. So we always want to start with ourselves and treat ourselves well. Be good to ourselves. There's nothing comes out of judging and berating ourselves and talking bad to ourselves and you know, trying to guilt ourselves about things. That is such a negative thing. And I don't know, sometimes the media or whatever think that that's the way, you know, be honest, constructive criticism. Yes, there's a time and place to be told if something's going on, hey, that wasn't really nice what you did, or, you know, maybe you can work on this better, this is something you need an improvement. But as I find, if someone needs improvement, if someone needs, you know, advice on something, or if you hurt somebody or you want to talk to someone, attacking them and putting them on the defensive, it never works. And nothing good comes out of it. It just ups the battle. It gets each person on the offensive, and it becomes a negative thing. So by being able to you know, be honest to someone who's hurt you or to someone you're upset with, and to kind of approach them in a healthy, growth, positive manner, really empowers you and gives you a different strength and a different empathy. Being able to feel what the other person's feeling, even if you're angry with them. And I think that's such a tough thing to do. And I think it's, you know, everybody struggles with that. And on my last show with Reverend Danny Garcia, he spoke about praying for our enemies, praying for those that have hurt us. And I know that sometimes it's like you might not be in a good position to even be open to that. Doesn't mean you have to, they totally don't have any responsibility of what they've done. No, it's not telling them that everything's okay, you can treat me like this. It's empowering yourself and in praying for them and hoping that some God changes their heart or that they heal. And by doing that, it's such an amazing, empowering act of kindness, act of selflessness, that you also free yourself of the anger, of the anxiety, of the hate, of the negativity, and also saying, this isn't about me anymore, this is about this person healing, this is about this person gaining insight and taking responsibility. But it's not your job to teach them. We have to do that all on our own. People can teach us lessons or show us lessons, But until we kind of go through it ourselves and have that moment and say, okay, and figure it out ourselves, people can tell us till they're blue in the face. We don't really experience it. But when we experience it, it really takes you to a different level. So that brings us to the end of the show. I just want to thank everyone so much for all your support, all your questions, and all your feedback. It has been just so amazing and so empowering. And I just, you know, I'm very, very happy that the show is really moving in the right direction and that I've really been able to help so many people and really touched people in their lives during hard times and giving them hope and just being able to empower them to move forward. So any questions or feedback, please send to insightintohealing@gmail.com. The song that brought us in the beginning was Every Good Thing by the Afters, and will be bringing us out. So everybody, good night, and God bless.